Welcome to Self-Compassionate Professor, a career wellness podcast for mid-career and recovering academics who want more. More meaning, balance, rest, joy, and more clarity. Our motto here is no regrets. So glad you're here. Hello, this is Danielle Delamar, and you are listening to episode 154.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for joining our conversation today. I'm talking to Dr. Jen Harrison, who is a dissertation coach. Jen, how's it going?
It's going great. I am super excited to be here with you today.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here too. Something that you'd said to me via email was, I really want to make sure we talk about the culture of burnout and toxic culture for grad students and how we can sort of transform that. And that just really landed with me, as I told you. It feels like a really, really important piece. And I'm so glad you brought it up so early on before we even had this conversation. So I guess let's start there. When you think about sort of your own experience in a culture of burnout, in a toxic sort of academic culture, what did that start with? How did it happen? Anything that sort of comes to mind?
Yeah, so I'm kind of an atypical case when it comes to how I got into academia. Like, I knew I wanted to be a teacher from like day one of being in school. Like the minute I saw what a teacher was, that's what I wanted to be my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I've jumped around from country to country quite a bit. So I did some of my education in the UK. I did some of my education in the US. I actually went to college in the UK and I did my PhD in the UK. So my initial experiences of academia were in quite a different academic setting. In the UK, there's a lot less teaching and a lot more research and a lot more lecturing and independence. So the setting is quite different. But when I came back to the US and I applied to work in academia, I started off as an adjunct, which is far more common here than it is in the UK. And as an adjunct, I think there is definitely a culture of burnout and kind of toxic competition and overload of work that it's much more extreme, I think, for adjuncts than it is for any other group within academia. And that seemed to be getting worse the longer I was here. I didn't even know what an adjunct was when I filled out the application form and got the job. So I was taken on as a full-time adjunct. And I was like, that's great. What's an adjunct? Like, how does that work? What does that term mean? I don't really know. And also, what do you mean I have to teach in a classroom? Like, what does that look like? Can I observe? Because I have no idea what your setup actually means. This is a million times different to what I was doing teaching in the UK. So, you know, I had to adjust pretty quickly to what seemed to me like a very harsh environment over here. And I stayed in that adjunct position for 5 years. The kind of setup in the school that I was in was that if you were full-time as an adjunct for 5 years, they would convert you to a tenure track position. And so, of course, that was like the gold standard. Everybody was competing for that. And there were a lot of adjuncts, and our union was really involved as well. So there was a lot of union action around protecting that ability for adjuncts. And of course, like the school had its own way of making sure that didn't happen. So you would get to 4.5 semesters and they would drop you down from full time for a semester and then put you back up again, that kind of thing. So it was a rough gig to be working. There was kind of no job security. There was a huge workload and very little respect. You know, you're second class citizen as an adjunct. And so that was kind of my introduction to what academia looked like here. It opened my eyes up to a lot of what I hadn't noticed in the UK as well. So I'm not saying the UK was any better. It's just that I didn't notice it back there. You know, academia was still shinier and new when I was in my UK position. When I was dropped into this very new environment and I had to evaluate what was going on and kind of learn what I was seeing, it kind of revealed that culture a little bit more to me.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, you describe it as a harsh environment, and I'm wondering what the sort of harshest pieces were.
So, you know, it's funny. You said if you have any good stories, and I was trying to think back, I'm one of those people who has zero long-term memory. So it's all kind of blurred into one terrible experience for me. Oh. But I did come up with two stories and like one key takeaway as well. So the story I think that I would go with for what the worst point looked like, I'm a children's lit specialist. So that's kind of my field of expertise. There was no children's lit in the department I worked in. So there wasn't a lot of recognition or kind of even acknowledgement of the work I did. You know, nobody kind of knew what it was. Like, oh, why are you writing about Winnie the Pooh? Isn't that something that little kids read? And I got accepted to the MLA conference in Chicago to present a paper, which was like amazing. Like everybody wants to go to MLA. And this particular conference was over the Christmas period. So we had finished the fall semester. We hadn't started the spring semester yet. And I didn't know if I had a contract yet for the spring. So, you know, that was the first thing. Like, I did not know if I still had a job. I'd had to buy plane tickets for Chicago. It was my husband's birthday, and we couldn't afford, like on an adjunct salary, we could not afford the plane tickets and two nights in Chicago. So we had decided we're going to fly the same day as the conference, which everybody knows is a bad idea. Like, never do that. Don't fly the same day as your presentation. So of course the flight was like 6 hours delayed. And so I'm sitting in this airport. It's my husband's birthday. And instead of like doing something fun, we're sitting in an airport waiting room. I don't know if I have a job. I've just spent a whole lot of money on plane tickets that the university now isn't going to reimburse because I haven't been able to present because I've missed my presentation. I don't know that my travel insurance will cover the delay because it wasn't an actual cancellation. So it was just like money stress. It was job stress. Like, I was doing this thing for my career for zero recognition, zero reimbursement. And I didn't even know if I still had a job. And I just remember, like, you know, we finally made it to Chicago. We'd missed everything. We found this like hotel dining room, and I just sat there and cried. And I was like, I don't even know why I'm doing this. Like, why the hell am I here? Why am I here? Yeah. Why am I doing this? Like, for whom? Who is gaining from this? I think that was the low point of the whole experience.
And did you, when you find yourself sort of crying there, did you have an answer like right away? Like, why am I doing this? Or did it take some time to sort of percolate?
Oh my gosh, no, there was no answer. There was no time to think about it, you know? Like when you work in academia, it's just one hit after another, one thing after another. Like, you don't have time to stop and reflect on what just happened because you've got the next six things on the to-do list to get done and like seven emails from students who will need a piece of you. So there's no time to reflect. I'm trying to remember when that was. Like, I feel like that was around 2017. And like, I didn't stop and reflect on what I was doing in academia and what I wanted and what was good for me until the pandemic in 2020. Like, that was the first point at which I was able to even start thinking through any of this.
I think that the whole, I had no time, I had no answers because I had no time, I had no reflection, no space to reflect. I think that is such a big piece of this for so many of us, right? We know something's wrong. We know it's not working for us, but we just can't get it together enough to take the first step because we are just so buried in all the to-dos. So I'm wondering, like, that certainly that resonates with me. So it was the pandemic. It was like that big slowing down time. Yeah. I guess what came out of that sort of pause, that slowing down, when you really realize, wow, maybe this really isn't for me. And the next step is this. And what was that next step?
So, like, I think a lot of people stopped during the pandemic and paused and reevaluated and thought, I don't think I would have done it unless I'd been forced to. So when pandemic hit, the university just wholesale got rid of all adjuncts. Like, that was it. Nobody had a full-time schedule. I think I dropped down to a single class and then I was gone. So I had no job and I didn't have anything I could do about that. I didn't have a choice about reevaluating. It was kind of, you need a new career. You're not going to pick up your two young kids and your husband who has a good job and like move them randomly around the country looking for some university that's still taking on adjuncts. Like, that's not viable. So something else has to happen here. Now's the time to stop and think, what do you want that to be? And like I said, I always knew I loved teaching. Like in all the various careers and iterations of what I've been doing over the years, it's always come back to teaching. I like helping students. And so I had to look for a way that I could do that outside of the university context. And obviously, you know, you announced me at the beginning, I'm a dissertation coach. So that's what I did. I opened a dissertation coaching business. It took a little while to get there and to kind of figure out what I was doing. But I had a really good business coach who kind of walked me through it. And a big part of what he made me focus on was the whys and the hows, and particularly the wellness aspect of the hows. So, you know, pretty much the first question he asked me when I went to him wasn't, you know, what are your business goals, or, you know, what do you see your ideal salary being? He wanted to know, like, what do you want your work day to look like? What do you want your ideal kind of space to be in this new career? And he's like made me focus on that in a way that was never the case in academia. Like, nobody cared if I was doing well, or maybe they did care, but they never asked, you know?
Yeah. And I'm wondering, did you have at first, because I'm thinking when you come from academia or really, you know, corporate or any sort of institutionalized place where you have to follow rules and you don't have that kind of freedom. Did you find it difficult to answer that question, those questions early on? Like, what do you want your work to look like? Oh, I don't know. Did you have that? Or did you know right away?
No, that was 100%. I was like, I don't know how to answer that question. What do you mean? Like, he was like, how many days of work a week do you want to do? And I'm like, wait, that's an option.
And so what was the processing like? What kind of time did it take for you as you reflected to finally sort of figure out what you really did want it to look like?
So it's taken a little while. He gave me a lot of guidance. He was like, okay, you have no idea. Here's what I'd recommend. And so we've kind of worked from there, you know, working out, oh, okay, this does work for me or this doesn't. But the piece that we've always come back to is what I struggled with and rejoiced in academia is exactly the same thing that my students are struggling with and rejoicing in academia. So I have the tools and experience to help them not have the same experiences that I had, as well as to help them get their dissertations done. And that's kind of where we go from, you know, what advice are you giving your students? Okay, give yourself that same advice. Mm. Or what advice would you want your students to have? Give yourself that same advice.
Ooh, that's good. Yeah, great. And in some ways, and I don't know if this is true for you, this is how it lands for me though. I see the work I do as sort of like healing myself, in the past, like back then, just like you were saying, you know, back then, this is what I wished I would have had. And so I try to give that to other people, but it also feels like I'm healing that sort of past me while I'm doing that. Does that land for you at all?
Yeah, it really, really does. And like, it's worth saying, because I think I've said a lot of negative things. Like, I had a great time in academia. I loved being an academic. I loved the work I did. I had some awesome experiences. So like, it's not all negative, but definitely, like, I see my students now and I tell them the things I wish someone had said to me back then. Mm-hmm. Because there's no need for a lot of this to be perpetuating. And I think a lot of it perpetuates because people don't necessarily stop and think, because they don't have the time to stop and think.
Mm-hmm. What do you find yourself saying most often to your clients? That piece of advice that sort of sticks with you through most of your conversations?
I think the one that comes up the most often is that drive to work constantly. Mm. Especially for, you know, I work with a lot of PhD students specifically, and they feel like it's a very contained thing. You know, they'll get to the end of their program and some of them want to stay in academia, some of them don't, but it's very much a case of, well, if I push, I'll get to the end and then I'll be done. It kind of doesn't work that way. You know, once you get into a habit of pushing, it's hard to stop again, especially when everything you're hearing is, come on, you've got to get done. Why is this taking you so long? Let's go. You've got deadlines. Come on, keep going. Why have you stopped? And so my students, you know, so many of them just want to work. You know, they're saying, oh, I'm getting up at 6 a.m. and I'm doing my 12 hours and I'm not taking any breaks. And then mm-hmm. I don't mind working on this until midnight. I can get this in by, you know, 9 a.m. tomorrow. And so the top thing I end up saying to them all the time is, no, you need to stop, you need to pause, you need to make me time. That is just as important as reading those 10 papers or finishing that draft. You need to be telling yourself to take breaks, and you need to be advocating for the time you need, not to like a ridiculous extent. You know, don't tell your supervisor, oh, I need 3 more months to finish this paragraph. Like, that's stupid. But you need, you know, if they're pushing you, you know, I have so many students, especially just after the pandemic, were saying, oh, my chair wants to retire, so he wants me to get this done by next week. And, you know, the advice is, well, you know, good luck to your chair, but that's not fair on you. And you need to recognize that. Take the time you need to take to do this thing well and with your own wellness in mind. But, and especially if you're going to stay in academia, you can't, that's not sustainable. And we all know that. But I think that is the culture in academia. Like, just keep going, just keep going. Your students need you. Your research is important. You don't have time for a break. Keep going, keep going. Next committee, you know, next paper. It's never kind of supported that you might need a break, that you have a family, that you might have somebody in the hospital, that you might be struggling with grief, that you might be struggling with anxiety, that you just need time to sleep. Like, those things are just not respected very much, I think.
And then that all results in this, like, never being present, never showing up for anybody you want to, never showing up for your own values, never showing up for yourself. I mean, tell me where I'm wrong. What else would you say to that?
Yeah, no, I think that's totally the case. Like, you are made to prioritize the institution's needs over your own. I think people who go into academia and who go into teaching are the kind of people who are susceptible to that message. You know, we want to help. We want to do some good. We want to teach. We want to be there for students. And so that message resonates. You feel guilt that you can't do it all. And when they're telling you you should be doing it, you believe it. And then you're judged on it afterwards as well, which helps reinforce, you know, you got to do your portfolio and you've got to do your student evaluations. And they come back saying that you have been lacking in this particular area, so you can't have this other thing that you wanted. So it's just really toxic. You know, toxic is the word that's flying around out there, and it's accurate.
Yeah. What that's bringing to mind for me is this bit of advice that I heard from Gaber Mador. Is that how you say his name? Do you know how to say his name?
I don't.
I just feel bad that I may not be saying his name correctly. But he talks about the importance of choosing guilt over resentment. So so guilt is always a good idea to choose versus resentment. How does that land for you? Because when I first heard that, oh, it landed so well for me. I was like, that is truth.
Do you know, I hate the fact that we have to make that choice in the first place. I think that's just what jumps out at me. Like, it shouldn't be that way. There's no need for it to be that way.
I don't think it needs to be that way after you've done it for long enough where you've chosen guilt time and time again. You've chosen yourself time and time again. And then you start realizing after you've been choosing guilt for a while that maybe this is actually kind of nice. And then you start to trust it and not feel guilt as much. I don't know. That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking like the early stages of it are guilt. But then as you trust the process and the path, it becomes less about guilt. But I totally hear what you're saying. Like, that's a terrible decision to have to make. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a reality, but we'd like it not to be.
Right. Yes. Yes, absolutely. But I have found it helpful to be like, ooh, I'm feeling guilt right now. Ooh, that means I'm choosing me. Okay, that's probably a good thing, Danielle.
Yeah. And I think what would be helpful is if there were more people who are already in those authority positions in academia who are willing to have that talk with their colleagues and with their students, rather than like having to have that talk with yourself, like to actually say, it's okay to do this. Like, it's okay to choose you sometimes.
Okay. Yeah. And this is kind of what we want to get into, right? Like, that is one thing that we can do to start transforming this sort of culture of academia. What are some other things you're thinking about that you feel are really important?
Oh gosh, yes. Okay, so I have a whole list of them here.
Sure.
So I think the first one is when students come in, I think there isn't necessarily enough thought about what the reality of their experiences and abilities are compared to the ideal and what we would like students to be coming in with and what we came in with ourselves and what we think they should be able to do. So I think my first thing, like if you want to support your students and help them not go through what you went through, hear but don't judge their concerns and needs. So nearly all of the kids that come to me, kids, that's ridiculous. Nearly all of the students that come to me, as like most of them are older than me. Nearly all of them are struggling because they don't understand what they're supposed to be doing. So nobody's taught them what a PhD is supposed to look like. What is a dissertation supposed to look like? What does good research look like? Where do I find sources? What do you mean a problem statement? What even is, like, they don't know this stuff. And there's no reason they should, because it's not taught at any point, anywhere, really. Mm-hmm. They probably come from an institution that isn't your institution. So you're like their point of contact. You're their source of knowledge and guidance and just security. Like, you're their security blanket. And I don't think a lot of people think that way about their grad students, but a lot of them need it. And to know that you're there for them and you'll listen and you'll provide them some guidance, like, that is just the number one top biggest thing that they all want so much. And that helps them, you know, it helps them move through quicker, it helps them do better work, and it helps them to understand that it's okay to not know everything, to ask questions, to need help. So, you know, I would say assume that they don't know anything and then be there as a guide and a security blanket and teach them it's okay to ask questions. It's okay not to know yet what you're doing. That's what I'm here for. I'll help you get there. It's okay to ask for help. I think that's kind of the first thing. And then the second thing I would say is model for them that you don't have to neglect yourself or your family for your institution's needs to be successful. So show them you take weekends off. Show them that you don't answer emails after 5 p.m., but you will get back to them the next day. Show them that you have a spouse or children or that you're a carer and that you take time for that as well as for their needs and the institution's needs. Because then they see, oh, okay, this is a normal thing and this is the way it should be. And so when I'm doing my work, I'm going to model what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things like thoughtful communication practices, taking time off and breaks. Like, don't tell them you've got to get this done. Tell them, all right, I think you should work on this next, but make sure you take some time out for this as well. And then I would say, like, always review every piece of instructional documentation that you're ever going to give a student, because so many of them, like, they're not clear at all. They are so confusing and they just cause hassle and frustration. Like, sit down with somebody who knows nothing about a dissertation and read through that document and say, do you understand what this document's asking you to do? Because if it's not understandable, like, then you have to do that job yourself and you're adding to your workload as a chair or a supervisor or a professor. You know, just make sure that where you can provide a written explanation that will cut everybody's confusion and workload, like, do that, because it helps. And then the last one probably isn't for any of your listeners, because I feel like the people listening to this podcast already prioritize this stuff. But don't take on a student you don't have time for, and never tell your student that you're too busy for them. It's such a killer to their self-esteem and their sense of worth. And, like, let's smash that toxic hierarchy. Like, there is no one professor who's too important and too busy for the incoming generation. Like, that just shouldn't be the thing. Like, we're all worthwhile in that department. So never tell them you're too busy for them. You're too important for them.
Wow. I love it. I love your list. So there should never be a professor that's too important and too busy for their students. And it's funny, like, that lands definitely is truth for me, but it's funny because that is exactly sort of what we're taught. Like, I have to slip in when I can. Like, I have to, like, I remember I had an advisor. I walked in to his office and he's like, don't sit down. I don't have time for this. Don't sit down. Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, like, it wasn't like ideal circumstances. Like, I hadn't, like, made an appointment or like, so there's all that. And so I think, like the thoughtful communication part is important, right? If you set up this like, okay, we're going to have these meetings and I'm going to show up for you and I'm going to be there for you. These are the times I can't be there for you. That would have been really helpful for me. But I walked out of there feeling like I was like, just sort of a drag on his time.
The lowest of the low. And that's what I hear from my students, you know, like, oh, you know, my supervisor hasn't reviewed my work for 3 or 4 months, but you know, it's okay. He's really busy and important. Like, I understand. Yeah. And I'm like, well, but no, that's a really long time frame. And they agreed to take you on as a student. So if you are so overloaded, and I know this is the case, like, again, like I'm giving a very student-centered perspective here, but I've been on the other side as well. Like, I know professors are busy, they're overworked, massively overworked, they're given way too much to do. If you have the choice to take on a student, so you're not being forced to do it, and you know that your workload means that you're going to have to tell that student, I'm too busy for you, I can't review this for a few months, don't take that student on, because it's not fair on them. And what you're teaching them is take on more than you can manage and then don't do a good job of it. And that's not a message you want to pass on.
Amen. One of the things I'm thinking about is your work as a dissertation coach. I talked to somebody a few years back who said to me that she had just gotten a dissertation coach. And she said, and I remember her metaphor. She said, like, this person she was working with was remote, but she said it felt like she had taken her hands, and her hands were really warm and buttery. And she just felt like she could just sink into this woman's support. She could just sink into it. She could be held by it. And she said she knew she made the right decision in going with a dissertation coach because she had never felt that when working with her own advisor. I think that's why so many of us, like you, dissertation coaches are out there and we're wanting, I say we, I'm not a dissertation coach, but like, they're wanting to do the good work in a way that they didn't maybe get to do as an academic themselves. So I don't know. What is your response to that? Tell me where I'm wrong. Anything you want to say?
No, I think that is 100% true. Like, it is not normalized within institutions to offer help and to offer guidance to anybody, like your colleagues, to your students. There's very much an attitude, and it doesn't come from everyone, but there's very much an attitude of, you should know this. You should know this already. You should know what you're doing. Like, if you don't know what you're doing, you're probably not good enough to be here, which is ridiculous. You know, it's a learning institution with the emphasis on learning. We should be learning. Nobody's finished at any point. I feel that was the case. Like, I spent most of my time as a professor, worrying about, I've got to get my portfolio in. My student evaluations are coming up. I need to be on this committee. I haven't done enough of this thing that they want or that thing that I want. And that took away time from focusing on students. Mm-hmm. And when they come to me, you can kind of tell how long they've been in their programs or been in academia by how willing they are to accept the help that you offer as a coach. You know, some of them find it very hard to break away from that shame of having sought some help and will, you know, I'll be saying, send me your work with some feedback, you know, let's jump on a call so I can explain this to you. And they're like, no, I've got it. It's okay. But you know, this is what I'm here for. I'm here to offer you the help. It's okay to take that help. And then the ones that are just starting out, you know, they're much more open to, like, oh, really? You can help me? Because my supervisor kind of wasn't going to do that. But if you can do it, great. I'm like, awesome. I have got you at the right point where I can train you that this is okay.
What I'm hearing you say is, I don't recognize my own needs the longer I've been in academia. Yes? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. My needs are not valid.
So tell me a little bit, because we talked about this before, a little bit about sort of symptom treatment. The kind of symptom treatment that you did as an academic versus sort of the holistic self-care that you do now. Because that really just triggered for me when you talked about grad students who are not like able to show up for themselves, able to do things for themselves in these sort of proactive, self-carey kind of ways. Because they're just managing symptoms. They're just trying to like put out the fires as they arise rather than take care of themselves more holistically. So say more about that.
Sure. So I think like we all know the obvious ones in terms of like managing your workload and so forth. But I think the one that comes up the most with my current group of students is like actual wellness, like health wellness. And I remember back, and of course, everybody's different when it comes to health and wellness and what they have and what they have to cope with. But I find that a lot of the things that I found as an academic working in academia that then stopped later for me are things that my students experience. And they ask about sort of on the side of asking about their work, like, oh, you know, by the way, I'm struggling with this. Do you have any tips? When I was in academia, I was always tired. I had high level anxiety, so I was treated with anxiety medication at that time. No time for myself, no time for my family. You know, like I said, we spent my husband's birthday in the airport lounge. Like, that's terrible. That shouldn't happen. I was sick with like colds and respiratory stuff all the time. Like, the minute we started that first day of school, somebody would come in sick and it would just carry on until the spring. Like, we used to joke about putting a Lysol shower spray above the office door so that we could like douse people as they came in. I had colleagues that used to just wipe every surface after every meeting, but we were always sick. Like, we were always sick. And then like I would use NyQuil and Benadryl to get to sleep every night because I was so anxious about what was going on at work, and I was depressed and I was working hard and I was getting nowhere. And I didn't know at the time, but I also have ADHD and I was undiagnosed at that point. So I was probably working even harder than I needed to be doing just to stay level. And since leaving academia, like, the things that I tell my students, take that slower pace, you'll get more done. Take that time for self-reflection and you won't be as susceptible to the depression, like, I'm working hard but I'm getting nowhere. And then it's kind of recognizing things that you might have that your institution doesn't recognize, like ADHD, and what tools can you use to manage that. So like for me, it was things like recognizing that if I used a to-do list and I used phone reminders, then I'd stay on top of my work list and that would cut my anxiety by quite a lot. Things like getting regular exercise, drinking enough water, setting your work boundaries. Like, I do not work on weekends because I have kids that need me, or I don't work evenings because I know that I have trouble sleeping and I need that wind down time. So like being able to set those boundaries, and that will help with things like anxiety, will help with depression. Know what your needs are. Like, you might have to take that 5 minutes to stop and identify them and work out what you need to look after yourself, to deal with those things, so that they aren't compounding all of the work-related stress and issues as well.
So this is what I wrote down. NyQuil, Benadryl, sanitizer, overworking versus slower pace, know your needs, and fulfill them. Wow.
Yeah.
And it's so much simpler. The latter is so much simpler. We just feel like we can't do it.
It's true. And like the message I think that needs to be heard is you'll probably get just as much done if you work hard for an hour, take a 30-minute break, and then work hard for another hour, as you would if you worked hard for about 4 hours.
Amen.
Because your brain will start to get tired. Like, you'll start to get tired. You'll start to make mistakes. You'll have to do stuff over. You'll be burnt out. So take that break. You're not robbing anyone of anything by doing that.
That's so real. You know, one of the things that I have noticed since leaving academia is my body tells me when it needs to lay down. It's like, it's time to lay down now. And I will do that in the middle of the day, right? Like, I will be between appointments and I will just go lay down. And sometimes, very often, I will fall asleep for 10 to 15 minutes. Like, my body will just go to sleep and then come right back up. And then when I come back to this next appointment, I am so much better off than I would have been if I'd have pushed through. And you're right. It doesn't take that much time. Like, a 15 minute nap is not that big of a deal.
I think there's like a psychological side to it as well. Like, yes, your body's getting the rest it needs, but your mind is also getting that reassurance that you will take care of you. My newest thing is a walk, like, not a nap, but I'll take myself outside and walk up and down for a bit, because otherwise I'm stuck in front of my computer for way too long.
Yeah, and I think it's seasonal for me because it's winter. I think lying yes. down is more of a thing. But like in spring and summer, I am more of a walker. Yeah, that's true. And I'm wondering, I mean, we've had this great conversation and I love talking about wellness. And I so appreciate all of your wisdom on the topic. Is there anything you want to make sure that we talk about to sort of end this conversation to make it feel complete to you?
I think I have a parting question for everybody who's listening, which is, how do you want to be remembered? Like when you think about your career, when you think about yourself as a teacher, how do you want to be remembered? And if you're struggling to make that decision about the advice to give a student or whether you should take a break or a holiday, like ask yourself that question. How do you want to be remembered? Do you want to be remembered as somebody who like worked and worked and worked until they burnt out, or somebody who was wise and kind and supportive and also smart?
What a great question. And I know you have something pretty awesome in terms of an offer for listeners. So tell us a little bit about that and then tell us how we can reach you.
Absolutely. So the offer is, if you are a professor or a student who's been listening and you know somebody who needs dissertation help or you need some dissertation help yourself, just email me, mention this podcast, and you can have a free 1-hour session with me. So if you want to reach me, again, my name is Dr. Jen Harrison. The email address is jen@readwriteperfect.com. Or you can go to my website, which is www.readwriteperfect.com. But again, mention this podcast and that session will be free.
Excellent. All right. And what is your stance on social media? I just have to ask because I have recently sort of decided that I'm done with it in many ways. I'm still on LinkedIn and I still like ask people to connect with me and that kind of thing. But I'm not going to post a lot. It is just not, it's not good for me in terms of wellness. I find that I'm way more sort of, I don't know, shaky and on edge and like looking for feedback and like it's taking me away from the stuff that really matters. So I'm just wondering, since we had this great conversation about wellness, what are you doing with social media and how is that working for you just as a business owner?
So I am such a reluctant social media user. I use Facebook because I have family who are abroad. So we share photographs on Facebook, and like that is my sum total of engagement with Facebook. And Twitter I'm supposed to use for my business, and like I swear I get a kicking every month from my business coach, like, you're supposed to be doing your marketing on Twitter. When was the last time you were on Twitter? I'm like, oh yeah, let me do some stuff now. So very, very reluctant, but trying to get better at using it. But like, I don't spread out on social media. I look at recipes on Pinterest, I look at family photographs on Facebook, and when I'm kicked to do so, I put stuff on Twitter and try and remember to read what's going on.
Which is why you're doing the podcast, right? See, I find it way easier to have a conversation than to be on Twitter or whatever. It sounds like you're the same.
Yeah, Twitter always feels like I'm jumping halfway into somebody's conversation, whereas like a podcast feels like a proper one-on-one.
Totally. Yes, I hear that. Okay, so should we be following you on Twitter? Do you think that's a good idea?
Why not? Go and have a look. If you're disappointed, I apologize in advance. So I do have a Twitter handle, but I'm going to have to hunt around for a minute to find it.
And I can put it in the notes, in the show notes too. So if you don't have it readily available, that's okay.
Oh my gosh, where do you even find your Twitter handle? There we go. I found it. It is @perfect_right.
Okay. I love it. All right. Sounds good. Hey, Dr. Jen Harrison, it was such a pleasure. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thank you so much for listening to Self-Compassionate Professor. This normally would be the time I tell you where you can follow me on social media, but I'm mostly quitting social media. It's the self-compassionate thing to do. I'm still on LinkedIn, but I rarely post.
So don't follow me. Send me a connection request and send me a message.
And as always, you can schedule a 20-minute consult at selfcompassionateprofessor.com. And I'm sending a wish that you too will do the self-compassionate thing, whatever that is for you. Take care.